All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi with Device Talks. Welcome back to Device Talks Weekly. I'm here with our fantastic managing editor, Kayleen Brown. Kayleen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I'm telling you, I don't think that you're going to get rid of me now. I'm addicted. So thanks for having me, and I will see you next week too.
Yes. No, there would be no desire to get rid of you. This has been a great addition to Device Talks Weekly. And I say this even having spent 2 or 3 days together this week. We're not even sick of each other. How's that?
Oh, we're not. Actually, if anything, I think we have too much fun. So if we had to pair something back, I think that we do a little less giggling, which yes. I don't actually agree with, because spending time with you is one of my favorite things to do.
I don't know if I want people to think of me giggling. I don't know if that helps my manly image. Do men giggle?
Well, here, I'll make it better. You giggle like a schoolgirl. Did that help?
You're piling on. That's making it worse. Oh, God. So we've got a great episode coming up a little later in the podcast. I'll be speaking with Sarah Hubar-Fisher, who's this new CEO of a company called BioRetech that has a very cool, reabsorbable material that's used for orthopedics implants. So we'll talk about that. And actually, BioRetech will be part of a Device Talks Tuesdays series we'll have later in November. But right now, we'll focus on Sarah's story and on BioRetech. So folks should stay tuned for that. And then prior to that, we've got an interview that our colleague Amira Weininger did with Julie Cole of Medtronic about ASCs. That's our FOMO of the week. So we've got a jam-packed episode as always. No new markers, newsmakers this week, though. Chris had some internet problems and we decided to punt, and I'm having a hell of Friday. So it all made sense just to move forward without a newsmakers. But there is lots of news. Go to massdevice.com to check it out. And Chris will be back next week. So Kayleen, back to this week. We had our first stage of our MedTech Nerd Tour. Want to tell our listeners all about it?
Sure. So I'll give a little behind the scenes first. We actually drove to the Santa Clara Convention Center. We wanted to check out this space. I know we'll be talking about Device Talks West later on, but we wanted to just to get a feel of the vibe, and we recorded a few videos. So we'll be putting that out on LinkedIn here shortly. So make sure you check that out, where we talk about how does one create a conference and why does one create a conference and all of the wonderful people that you can expect. So that was always really fun, and being able to nerd out with you on a nerd tour with video and equipment and med tech and one of my favorite people in the world. I mean, my cup runneth over. So that was a perfect way to kick it off. And then we went straight from the convention center to the MedTech Women MedTech Vision Conference. We had a little reception the day before. Weather was perfect. It was so nice seeing, I always say, like, it's, you know, I've been saying that MedTech is so familial, but it really is. So just showing up, it was immediately like, oh, it's so good to see you. Hello, 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 hello. And only got to see a fraction of our MedTech friends, but what a great way to kick it off. And then we moved in the next day for a full day of conference. The theme this year was revolution, not evolution. And I think that they once again hit the nail on the head. And this was Yvonne Bachelman's first MedTech Vision Conference and knocked it out of the park, Yvonne. It was fantastic. I know you're always full, or she is always fully supported with a great team, but wow, it was really great. And a couple of thoughts just popped in my head. We really talked through artificial intelligence. I think that was a big theme. And I think that you sat in on the AI panel as well, and you had said it was one of your favorite of the day. So we talked through that. And then I think there was a lot of focus on sort of the patient experience and how do we get information to patients and how MedTech in general needs to do a better job in, of course, a very positive action forward way. So it was really great to be in that room, feel that energy with 249 of my closest friends. It was just best time of the year.
No, it was a fantastic event. I did need to step away for a couple hours in the midday to go run a webinar, one of our Device Talks Tuesdays, and I did it at Stanford Biodesign. So I wanted to thank them publicly for making the space available. But I really did enjoy the morning session, which I kind of highlighted last week. Gretchen Brown is VP of Chief Nursing Information Officer, or VP and Chief Nursing Information Officer at Stanford Health, was on a panel with Carla Goulart-Perrone of Philips. She's Chief Medical Officer there. Lucille Blaise-Savage of ResMed, and Stephanie Franklin-Thomas of Medtronic. And it was really a great panel, a great way to start the panel. They had a lot of serious messaging to deliver, but they did so with humor and clarity, and really did sort of underline a point that I know you've made, Kayleen, on our Device Talks AI podcast and other podcasts, that that AI really has the opportunity to provide sort of a forward face for medtech and really sort of put it out in front of patients more clearly and more directly. So it actually left me feeling hopeful about AI. So that's that was the pendulum swing of the moment. I was feeling like this could be a potentially good thing. So it was a great way to start the day. And I was very glad to be back there in late afternoon for the final panel. And of course, the awarding of the Farrell and Powell Award. I know you had a little bit of a brush with greatness with the winner.
Okay, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to tell you really first. I'll just keep our audience not in suspense. And this year's Farrell and Powell Award winner was Virginia Giddings, who's mm-hmm. the Vice President of Exploration for Edwards Life Sciences. And Virginia has an incredible history with medtech. It's been around for decades and has been in really prominent positions the entire time. And besides being a fantastic person, here's the fun run-in. It's lunchtime. I had been in session for most of the morning. I had some critical work that I just had to do. So I had my laptop on my lap. I was finishing it. I look at my watch. I'm like, oh no, I only have 15 to 20 minutes to scarf down some food before the session starts again. And I don't want to miss a second of it. So I rush over to the lunch area and Virginia is sitting there with an open seat next to her. And it didn't even process who she was for a moment. And I sat next to her and I was like, hi, you know, I'm Kayleen Brown. And she's like, I'm Virginia. And she goes, this is my daughter. And she points to her daughter who's next to her, 23-year-old, also in the medtech industry. So we were talking about, oh, how do you get your child into medtech? That's what I want to do. You'll give me those best practices. And we're enthusing about the industry and we're enthusing about life together. And then I share with her, I'm so excited to see who's going to win the Farrell and Powell Award. And she goes, me too. Mike, do you have any idea who it is? And she looks me dead in the eye and she says, I have no idea.
Nice.
And it didn't occur to me to look at her daughter, who was cracking, by the way. She could not keep it the same way that Virginia was. And then when I saw Virginia receive the award, that was the first thing that went through my thought. It was like, you sneak. You got me hook, line, and sinker. But really, that was so well-deserved. Such a win. I was part of the standing ovation. And Virginia, congratulations.
Absolutely. No, it was a great presentation. As always, Deb Kirkpatrick introduced her, and they've been friends for a long time. So really gave her really told her story well. So as you said, great day. Always a favorite of ours. And great job by the folks at MedTech Women. And they've moved the date to next year. I think it's September 15th. I think they moved it up a week. So folks can circle that day and make sure they're part of that. We've got our own conference coming up. We've got Device Talks West happening October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. As Kayleen mentioned, we'll have some videos we recorded at the convention center. So we're talking about the program. We would very much love to see you there. That you can register at west.devicetalks.com. When you do use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25%, because we love our podcast listeners. And please check out the agenda. We've got great keynotes, starting with Tim Schmidt at Johnson & Johnson MedTech. They've just done a fascinating investment in Renovo. We'll have Ray Cohen, the former CEO of Axonics, talking about that experience in building companies. Anis Dwa of Moon Surgical, and Aman Jetty of Intuitive, our keynotes the next day. And of course, I should mention also Josh Macauer of Stanford, who hosted me, was kind enough to host me this week, will be a keynote as well. So we've got lots of great keynotes, lots of great discussion centered around connected health, neurointerventional tools, cardiac, more and more and more. We'll have a jam-packed engineering theater on the floor. So make sure, folks, that you're there. And Kaylin, I know you have some exciting news regarding the Device Talks West programming. Give our listeners an update.
It's big news. So this has been something that I've been hoping would happen. So I'm going to do a little drum roll. Our fireside guest for this Device Talks West Women in MedTech Breakfast is the VP of Global Cardiac Surgery for Intuitive, Darla Hutton.
That's
boom. Yeah. Confetti. But really, I'm so excited. So Darla joined Intuitive back in April. And as soon as I saw that announcement go through, I went, this is a really interesting placement. Darla has a lot of experience outside of industry as well, which I always think brings a really fresh perspective, and reached out immediately to our incredible Intuitive contacts and said, is there a possibility? Would Darla be willing to speak? Understanding that she's new to the role and sometimes there's some hesitancy there, but I think that freshness, that perspective would be really valuable. And I'm so proud to say that Intuitive understood what we were trying to achieve completely, was so supportive, and that Darla's excited, I'm excited, and we have a call set up for next week to talk through what this year's theme will be. And once we have that locked down, I'll announce the theme, and then we'll put our talking points around that, and magic ensues from there. But so grateful to Darla Hutton, so grateful to Intuitive, and so grateful to our sponsors who allow us to continue to do the Women in MedTech Breakfast.
That's such a great, great get for Device Talks West. I mean, Intuitive obviously has been in the news, well, for the last decade or so, but the last year in particular, and their move into cardiac is extremely exciting, or their move back into cardiac. And to hear how Darla is looking at that, but also looking at sort of the broader issues facing MedTech, I think it's going to be a great conversation. Folks can register to attend the breakfast. Is on day two, right? The morning of the day two morning. And it's just a fantastic infusion of energy, I think, in the middle of the conference. So folks can also register for that at west.devicetalks.com. All right. Well, very quickly, we've got the AdvaMed meeting coming up, Kaylin. You and I will be there. Another part of our MedTech Nerd Tour. So folks, if you want to meet up with us there, please reach out on LinkedIn. We'd love to connect and say hello. More immediately next week, we'll have our Connected Health series on Device Talks Tuesdays. We've got three episodes on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, noon each time. On Tuesday, I'll be speaking with Eric Benjamin. He's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, a new title for Insulet. We'll be talking about Insulet's connected health strategy. On Wednesday, I'm excited to have a conversation with Conrad Goodmanson, who's the VP of Strategy for Lucem Health. And Lucem is a connected health / AI effort connected with the Mayo Clinic. And they've got partnerships with companies like iRhythm, helping them find their way. So that's an awesome opportunity for folks to listen to how the Mayo Clinic is and how Mayo Clinic and other leading providers are looking at connected health. I think it's a great insight, again, on customers of med tech companies. And then on Thursday, I will be talking with Omid Farazan, who's the Vice President of Clinical and Medical Affairs at Syncron. So Syncron's one of the BCI companies, the brain-computer interface companies. Not connected health just yet, but will be connected health someday. And Syncron is one of the leaders in the space. I know everyone on LinkedIn likes to talk about Neuralink, et cetera, for obvious reasons. But Syncron, I think, is really the trailblazer in this regard when it comes to dealing with the FDA and getting this technology through. So we'll have Syncron next week. And also Kurt Hagstrom, the chief commercial officer for Syncron, will be at Device Talks West on our neuro panel. So folks can register for the Connected Health series. Just go to devicetalks.com. You can register for one or all three. And it's a great opportunity for you to learn live or learn when it's convenient for you. And the entire series is sponsored by our very good friends at New England Wire Technologies, S3 Connected Health, and Maxon. Okay, well, enough about next week, Kayleen. Let's focus on this episode.
Yes. So for our audience, I hope you enjoy a conversation with our producer, Amira Weiniger, with Julie Cole, Senior Director of Enterprise Accounts and ASC Strategy for Medtronic. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Future of MedTech series. I am joined by Julie Cole, the Senior Director of Market Development and Strategy for ASCs at Medtronic. Julie, welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, we are so excited to talk about ASCs because I think that there is no question ASCs are definitely playing a role in the future of the MedTech industry. But before we dive into that, I want to hear a little bit more about you. How did you find your way into MedTech? And then maybe how did you find your way from MedTech to the ASC side?
Sure. Well, I started my career in hospital administration. I was in a hospital in Houston, Texas, and worked my way up through service line directors. And as part of that role, I got to know medical device industry a little bit more, and specifically Medtronic. I worked with them a lot in our cardiac cath lab and in our neuroscience operating rooms, and they recruited me from Houston to Minnesota. I've now been in the MedTech space for 18 years, carried a lot of that knowledge from the hospitals over to MedTech, which has been really instrumental and helpful in my career. And a few years ago, watching all the changes inside of service, I was asked to come join the ASC team, a newly formed team about 5 years ago at Medtronic, really focused on how we approach the ambulatory surgery center market and how we look at them not as just small, price-sensitive hospitals, but as distinct sites of service with really individualized needs.
Yeah, I can imagine that your background in hospital administration probably really led naturally to this fit. But it is interesting that you say that these are not just mini hospitals. I love that. That's a great way to phrase that, because I think sometimes that is what we think about them. And to that end, what are some of those challenges, perhaps maybe some of the misconception and the challenges that you're seeing as we try to adopt more ASC usage in the medtech industry?
Well, there's some really specific challenges to MedTech and why some of us fear in MedTech the shift of side of service. And when I think about those challenges, I really think twofold. One is our service support and coverage model. In MedTech, a lot of the procedures that our devices are used in also require clinical support. So we have representatives in most of the operating rooms when our devices are being used. Now, when we think about coverage, we have 6,000 Medicare-certified hospitals in the U.S., but now layer on top of that 6,000-plus Medicare-certified ambulatory surgery centers. So the number of locations that we now have to cover and provide clinical support doubled. The challenge being is that the procedure volume didn't double. In fact, it was really just a redistribution of cases. Some stay at the hospital, some transition over to the ambulatory surgery centers, and we have to find a way to keep our support consistent, regardless of that side of service. And the answer is never just doubling the number of people, given that our revenue and cases haven't doubled. So that's one big challenge MedTech faces. Another is as you shift to the ambulatory surgery center, often reimbursement lowers. Now, that can be good if you're looking at broader healthcare goals of cost constraints, but it can be a challenge on device margin. So we now have to come up with ways to make sure we're maintaining the value we have in our products, but we're also trying to figure out how to economically support the viability of ASCs, but also our businesses. So those two challenges really come into play. And so we have to kind of think a little bit differently as we approach the ASC market.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are two such different challenges.
Yes.
So I'm going to throw in an additional question because I find it very interesting the way that you've described this. How has the separation between the ASCs and the hospital surgeries, has that just naturally evolved so that there was just these are more elective surgeries, or are these are just less sick patients? Like, how did that transition occur?
It's evolved over time, and it's typically led with technology innovation.
Okay.
So as our technology becomes more minimally invasive, safer, more effective, more predictable and consistent, that allows procedures to shift out of the hospital into a lower cost setting. So ASCs years ago started with very, very simple procedures, but now in the last few years, we're seeing a lot of increasing complexity in the cases. Higher acuity patients are moving over, but that's because the technology is allowing those procedures to be performed very safely and effectively with very consistent outcomes. So as that occurs, as technology advances, more procedures are able to shift.
Okay, I see. That makes
sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that makes sense. And so that leads me to immediate future. What is the immediate future of the ASC market look like? What is going to happen with the medtech industry right now, like in the next year? What are we looking at when it comes to ASCs and medtech?
So the immediate future is, one, we have to answer that coverage question that we have. There's a couple of different ways that I know medtech is looking at that. One popular choice is to create dedicated ASC teams. So these are teams that are very nimble, sometimes regionally based, can cover a large footprint. Often this clinical support team can cover more types of cases than what we would traditionally see in the hospital. So that's one way. The second way is we're adopting remote technologies. So how can we create our expertise and instead of having always a one-to-one model, have a one-to-many model? So really tackling the coverage aspect is important. The second piece is, how do we wrap our arms around the economics so that we all remain viable? Part of that is we look at very specific needs of the ASC in terms of cases. So ASCs, even though they're growing in complexity, typically have a finite number of procedures they're going to do in a given ASC. So can we do kitting? Can we really look at the products and how we package them and just provide exactly what they need for those cases? Nothing more, nothing less, because they don't have the variability that the hospital typically does. So can we reduce costs by ASC-specific products? We also look at opportunities for flexible business models with ASCs. We've learned that on average, ASCs have 30 days cash on hand. That's a challenge. So can we look at different pricing models or flexible payment terms that allow us to get what we need for devices, but allow them some flexibility in how they spend their money?
Yes, those are all very, that makes a lot of sense. It really does. And I can see all of those things being adopted. I particularly am interested in how maybe ASCs are going to help solve some of our healthcare desert situations.
Yes.
We are such a massive country. My husband is active duty military, and so we don't live in urban centers very often. And so one of the things that's so exciting about ASCs is perhaps like this expanded coverage that may be allowed. So when you said, you know, this care, one-to-one care versus one-to-many, it's a really exciting area, I think.
It's extremely exciting. When you think of an ASC, they are less expensive to build than hospitals. So you can expand capacity in a much less expensive way, which allows you to reach some of these rural settings that we weren't able to go to before. ASCs allow a lot of flexibility for our providers. So we're seeing specialists go out a little bit further to participate in an ASC because they have the opportunity to have some of that operational control or that financial investment. Mm-hmm. So I think ASCs are ultimately a really good thing. They are driving down the cost of care. For med tech, that makes us become creative and innovative. Are we producing the right technology for the right patient in the right site of service?
Which we love in med tech. That's what we want to do. We want to be innovative, and it gives us that additional opportunity. Yeah. And so I think we're already kind of touching on this. I'm going to go into my last question, which is, okay, so let's zoom out even further. Yeah. A decade from now, what does this look like?
Well, the future's bright, I think, in med tech. I really do. I think you'll continue to see a push towards minimally invasive technologies. So you'll see a lot of technology innovation with smaller, more intelligent devices. That minimally invasive allows for safety and efficacy. I think you're going to see data-enabled care more. So how are we using the data we get from our devices? How are we wrapping AI around that to help make procedures more consistent? To help with remote patient management for those patients that are far off and they need management after a procedure. How can we use AI to help enable that better? The third thing I think you'll see in medtech is going to be a focus on earlier intervention. Are we able to engage patients earlier in the disease process and maybe slow or prevent the progression of disease? And I think you'll see all of that wrapped in a different service model where we're able to reach more locations and more providers more efficiently.
Well, I agree, Julie. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you. The future
is absolutely bright. Thank you so much for joining us for the future of medtech.
Thank you, Amira Weininger of Device Talks, for talking with Julie Cole of Medtronic. All right, now we'll have my keynote conversation with Sarah Huber-Fisher, CEO of BioRetech. Once again, BioRetech will be part of a Device Talks Tuesdays series in November that's looking at new materials in medical devices. Well, Sarah Huber-Fisher, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
I'm excited. Congratulations on your appointment, by the way. You're now CEO of BioRetech. First of all, let's find out about your story. How did you find your way into the medtech industry?
Yeah, so I started pretty early, right out of undergrad. I was in New York City, and I was recruited by J&J initially into the farm sector. And I spent the first 18 months of my, let's call it, healthcare career in farm. And in that period, in 18 months, we grew the market share over 100%. But I still felt unfulfilled in, like, where's the deal? I didn't feel a deal closer.
Yeah.
So I expressed that, you know, being young and naive and not worrying about what you say. I just said, look, this is great, but I'm not like closing any
deals. This
is
really boring.
Yeah. I don't think this is my thing, you know? And they were like, okay, well, maybe you're more of a device person. Maybe you're a med tech person, right? Maybe you like deals.
You're one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, okay, no idea what that was about. And at that time, it was, you know, early 2000s, like the late 90s, early 2000s period, where medtech was predominantly, if you looked around, it was very male, very ex-military kind of recruiting they were doing. And so I thought, well, I'm not sure how I fit into that mix. But there was one slice of commercial recruiting in medtech that I did kind of hit the mark on. And that was that I was a former athlete, and they really loved commercial people that were former athletes, you know, competitive, driven. So I had played Division I basketball in university, and that just hit a mark for them. And they said, okay, great. You know, we've got a new collaboration going on with this Israeli company called Given Imaging. This was all around the time of capsule endoscopy and the PillCam. And, you know, we're thinking about doing a marketing collaboration with them, and we're looking for our first commercial people to introduce this into the market, and we need somebody for New York. So I jumped at it and was like, you know, sign me up. I want to go. What are we going to do? What are we introducing? You know, how does this work? And it had, I loved every single minute of the painful new technology introduction period that we went through, with the cultural clash between the companies, the paper forecasting that was ridiculously off, the response that I would get from New York City physicians and clinicians to the price we wanted or the value prop we were, you know, told to sell. But I loved it. I loved learning the business of healthcare from a bunch of New York City physicians who would just tell you in 2 seconds flat whether what you were trying to sell had any legs or was the next dumb idea, right? And I remember speaking to one of them in Brooklyn when I got to a point where I realized, maybe this plan is really off. So I started saying, like, something they tell you never to do in novel technology introduction, which is, what I started asking, what would you use this for? You know, if you don't like it for what it's indicated for, what would you use it for?
Fine, you figure it out.
Yeah. And I got great ideas from physicians in New York at the time that eventually Given Imaging continued on to use.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So then I realized that I really loved that new technology introduction space. That I was much more of somebody who liked to get out in the market and figure out how to get new tech to use and what the real value was than I did just pushing, you know, growth and numbers. So I really realized that was my shtick, let's say. And so did one of my mentors in J&J. And so we continued to work together in that for a number of years.
That's great. I want to continue that story, but you played, you mentioned your college ball. You played at UNC, right? I mean, that's a real program?
Yeah, I actually started off at Seton Hall for 2 years, and then I transferred down into North Carolina. And so that was also a great experience. Enjoyed every minute of that.
Unpack that. That's sports. I love sports. I'm not an athlete. My kids aren't athletes, but you know, there is this culture, particularly within sales, but the sports translation to business success.
Yeah.
Is that automatic? What did you carry from that experience to your career?
I guess I didn't realize how much discipline we had. You know, I thought everybody around me at that time was an athlete, right? Athletes roomed with athletes. We dormed with athletes. We hung out with athletes. We didn't get summers off. We trained through the summer. So I didn't know that that was an abnormal way to spend your university year. So I just thought like, yeah, I mean, am I working as hard as the next person? So I think there's a lot of discipline that comes in with sports. And a lot of that kind of self-starter mentality. I mean, to wake up in the morning in the off season and show up. I mean, there are some required things to do, but then there's other things you can decide to do. And I was more of on the line of I always decided to do. So definitely was a just driven personality. My father was also an athlete. He played college sports as well. Both got recruited to play football at Syracuse and football at University of Michigan and basketball at Syracuse. So, you know, I think he loved driving that little competitive competitive spirit in me and kind of pushing me and teasing me at times. So I kind of grew up with that a bit. But yeah, I think it translates into you give a commercial person a target and they're going to go hunt it down and go get it. And that's really up to them, right? Like you're by yourself, you're out in the field. So I think sales and athletics does have that sort of that, similarity in personality type.
That's great. That probably gave you the insights too, to early on say when you were selling pharma, like this isn't, and I know what it feels like to achieve, and this is not it, and asking for more. So yeah, that's a great explanation. So where did you go from Given? What was next? Where did that journey take you?
So after Given, J&J was looking into what we called natural orifice surgery or NOTES at the time. Mm-hmm. So I remember doing some of the first cases there at Columbia University in New York City in the basement of Columbia while the sun was shining, standing in the dark and thinking, I'm not sure this is actually going to work out, by the way. Like, this seems like a very long procedure. I'm not sure the market's ready for this one. And then I stumbled into sedation systems or Sedasys, a product that was a class 3 PMA drug device combination technology backed by software. So I'm not quite sure it could get more difficult than that one. I mean, software wasn't even regulated by the FDA. There was no digital health agenda. Like this was pre that. We were calling India for tech support, I think, on software at that time. It was a combination technology, drug device combinations, which from a regulatory perspective, you know, is sort of the kiss of death. Nobody likes to do those. Those take extremely long time and are really complicated from reviewer teams, et cetera. So, you know, this was a really complicated technology. And when I joined, we were going through the process of actually putting it through FDA panel. And we won that panel. We had a successful panel. I think it was an 8-2 vote in favor of approving the technology. But then we became, at that particular time, the third time in history that the FDA made a different decision than the panel recommendation.
Oh, wow. The advisor.
So we became the third time that ever happened. And then as a result of which, I think it became the first technology across any sector that J&J worked in where they ever appealed a decision by the FDA. So this was a super controversial technology. And the only room we had to move then was it had conditional approval in Canada by Health Canada because we had a positive 8-2 vote. So they had assumed after the panel that we were going to get FDA approval. They gave us Health Canada conditional approval. Then we ended up not getting the approval in the States. So, you know, no surprise here, but then I became the first person to raise it. Like, send me, I'll go to Canada and go introduce this technology. Let me go get it used post-marketing. So we had a goal of getting it used on 1,000 patients in Canada. And I did that with myself and a nurse. And we did that across 5 different sites of care in 3 different provinces. successfully without any adverse events. And we like to hope and think that that data eventually was used to the led up to the FDA approval later on. But I loved that experience. And that's when I really became sold on, you know, med tech is such an interesting space because you have the first hurdle in watching that FDA panel and the brutal process that our teams go through from a regulatory perspective. And then once you get approval, you think, oh, then we're done. But it's just getting started again. Now you have technology adoption and changing workflows and who's going to use it and is your price point right? And is the timing of the market right? Right? Timing in med tech is everything. A lot of great technology kind of dies on the vine just because it's the wrong time or the wrong market. So all of that I learned in that period working on sedation systems and still, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears of that period is still some of my favorite people that I've worked with and definitely with some of my best experiences.
It sounds like a very startup-y experience.
Yeah. Just
you and a nurse and going out there knocking on doors.
I mean, I think real entrepreneurs will probably argue that you had corporate backing, so you never had to raise money, so you can take that element out, which is a fair argument. But every we were going back and saying, where are we? And have we hit milestones? And what do we expect? And, you know, revising our strategy or realigning with leadership within J&J about whether we could maintain our funding. So it was definitely an entrepreneurial experience for sure.
So Sarah, as we're talking, you're in Amsterdam, Bioretic is in Finland. How did you find your way over to Europe?
Yeah, so after that, the stint I did in Canada for about 3 years, I realized that I had that my appetite for international experience grew. And I thought, okay, Canada's, I guess, international. Wasn't enough. And I had a sister living in Switzerland at the time. So I thought, you know, now's the time for me to go abroad. And so I lobbied internally and asked, you know, to be relocated to Europe for a number of years. And I was lucky enough to have some mentors within the business, both in the European side of the business that were willing to pull me over. Took a while, but finally made my way over, and I chose Amsterdam as my place of, let's say, where I was going to be based out of, because it was clear that I was also going to be spending time on the road again, right? Spending a lot of time in planes, et cetera. And I was brought over for an operational post-acquisition operational turnaround. So I covered everything from LATAM, EMEA, and Asia-Pac regions to improve the communication between sales and ops and forecasting and targeting. And so that was a really big job and exposure to distribution, but it definitely fed that same operational bug that I had. And so I really enjoyed that as well. And it allowed you very quickly into internationalization and understanding markets outside North America. So it was a great first job to have once I moved over.
That's great. And how long did you stay at J&J? Looking at your, did you stay through 2023? Because I see some other roles with venture groups and things sort of interspersed in there. What's your career look like since the move?
Yeah. So I guess towards the end of my time at J&J in the last couple of years, I had a feeling that, you know, at a certain point I was going to need to branch out and move out of corporate and start to build a little bit portfolio of experience in parallel to what I was doing and maybe taking on some board roles or really understanding more about the venture capital space. And so I had joined a group of surgeons in external innovation towards the end of my career at J&J, which was a great role. I worked alongside, you know, top talent surgeons who had specific expertise in either surgical oncology or cardiovascular or orthopedics and robotics. And each of them was out scouting for the next best thing in that particular field. And I was their business partner who would pressure test whether or not we thought there was a market for it. So clinically, it's interesting. Technically, it's interesting. But now, is the market ready for it? So I worked alongside of them for a number of years. And in that role, we made the first fund of fund investment also in Europe into a fund that ended up performing extremely well and introduced me to the world of venture capital in Europe. And then continued to branch and build a network out within the venture capital community. And even while I was still at J&J, the International Venture Club of Europe had asked me to chair the healthcare subgroup of that. And even though I was stating, well, I'm not really a VC, I'm just, you know, kind of an external innovation type, they said, yeah, we don't care. We love it. You know, we love that you're so strategic. We want to get your opinions on things that we should be doing differently. Sure. So I really dove into that space and debated for a while if I was going to move from being operational to the investment side of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And really, I actually thought that's the direction I was going, and started getting introduced to some of these earlier stage venture funds who were looking for venture partners or operational partners with experience. And so I did that for a bit as well, in addition to the roles that I was doing. But one of the things I did then in 2021, which was 2 years before I left J&J, is I joined the board of Biotech. So I was approached by one of the Finnish investors that I got introduced to through that venture club in Europe. And he said, look, I'm on the board of a company right now, and we're supporting and we're invested in a company that is in the orthopedic space, and it's getting ready to prepare for U.S. go-to-market. Now, we need somebody on the board that knows how to do that, that's got experience there, and can help give the company guidance. So I got approval internally to join the board at that time, which was, it was still pre-commercial. So it was, I felt it was maybe even a little bit too early for my experience. But in retrospect, you know, all things happen for a reason. And it was in that period that I really got to spend time with my current CTO, who at that time was our CEO at Biotech, and understand his journey and his story and the passion that he had. And so became a big supporter of Timo Leitinen, who's my CTO, and built a relationship with him and tried to support the company as it was thinking about its go-to-market strategies.
So I want to unpack Biotech, or I said earlier Bioretic. I understand there's depending upon what side of the ocean you're on, you can pronounce it one way or the other. So we may switch back and forth. But it's a really, I think, fascinating offering for orthopedics. Talk a bit about the company. Introduce our listeners to Biotech.
Yeah, great. So Biotech, I like to think of Biotech as a company. There's pre-2020 Biotech, and there's post-2020. Biotech. Pre-2020 Biotech was a company that was born out of expertise in like polymer-based absorbables, so more along our Activa line. It was established in Tampere, Finland, with a focus on the next generation of safer and absorbable implants, because previous versions of absorbable polymer implants had historical issues. And this did some damage to the perception and the risk appetite for absorbable implants in general, I think, for some time in the market. Mm-hmm. And then around 2019, Biotech was reassessing its strategy. It had new leadership with expertise in material science. As I mentioned, my current CTO was the CEO at the time. And it acquired a spin-out from the University of Graz in Austria, which was led by Professor Annelie Weinberg. And she is a female pediatric trauma surgeon who was in search for a better solution for pediatric patients who were going through, you know, trauma operations. And mm-hmm. she saw the stress also that's associated with that, not only for the children, but also for the families, you know, who were having those experiences. So her research led her to focus on magnesium alloys. And alongside that, the avoidance of magnesium in combination with rare earth elements, which was a bit more common, I think, in magnesium-related research in terms of materials at that time. And the reason is that these rare earth elements, they accumulate in the body over time and they stay there for a lifetime. So that's obviously less than ideal for pediatric patients. And so after working through, let's say, a combination of 4 to 5 different generations of these alloy combinations, and she did this in collaboration with the leadership at ETH Zurich, or the Technical University of Zurich, the team landed on the current composition of magnesium, calcium, and zinc, which forms our Remios offering today. Mm-hmm. Timo, being the current CEO at the time, but really a CTO at heart, he and the team at Biotech continue to work then on that material science and the industrialization of that alloy from like small scale production to be into large scale reproducibility, and then into product development. And this is really the period where I feel that Biotech was reborn from a material science and an R&D perspective.
So was the focus then, well, talk about the Romeos products. Are they pediatric, still pediatric? Well, is your focus pediatric implants, or do you go more broadly? My quick overview, I thought it's a broader orthopedic offering for all patients, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So it is. It's adult and pediatrics. You know, the genesis, like, and the inspiration for Professor Anli Weinberg, of course, was, you know, nobody wants to do removal surgeries or surgery period in children, but definitely not removals. Pulling pins out of kids is never an ideal procedure to perform. And so I think the idea there was, you know, how can we move away from having to do these removal surgeries, these mm-hmm. risks of infections, continued risk of infection, you know, for fractures in children. But as you say, you know, our product lines, both for Activa and Remios, are used in both pediatric and adult populations.
Help me understand the process then currently. So these are inserted to provide support to a broken bone to allow it to grow back. And then at some point they're removed. What does that process look like? What do those procedures look like? I guess more broadly, trying to understand the problem that you're trying to solve or provide an alternative to.
So absorbables are a high growth segment, let's say within the orthopedic segment. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, you know, there's a desire to reduce the risk of infections. There's a desire to reduce the risk of secondary surgeries or removal surgeries. So you imagine you have a fracture that has like an external fixation that's, you know, holding, let's say, you know, the bone together pre-op. And that external fixation is basically a source for potential infection. So you have an open wound that needs to sit there for maybe a couple of weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a large risk of infection there, which obviously results in the use of antibiotics and other medications that, again, you know, are not ideal. If you can do a closed fixation where you're using an absorbable implant that degrades over time within the body, and then your own completely disappears and you're only left with bone regrowth in the case of Remios, that's an ideal situation, right? You now have one procedure, one implant, and you have your bone regrowth having supporting a natural healing process. So that's the idea of absorbables in general. Mm-hmm. Now there are different types of absorbables, as we mentioned, and we like to think of our absorbables from a materials perspective as being best in class. And why I say that, of course, is everyone would probably like to say that about their own products, but why I say that is that, you know, our Activa line, even starting with the polymers, we've always had market-leading mechanical performance in bioabsorbable polymers. And we're the first and only with self-locking and auto-compression technology that really supports healing and full absorption. And right now, we've had those implants have been sold. We've sold over, let's say, close to 400,000 implants have been sold globally, and we've had zero adverse events, which is pretty strong evidence of strong product leadership there. It's just that in the U.S., no one's known who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, we're working really hard now to ensure that our performance is well known and understood in this category. But when you move to more, let's say, more load-bearing applications, it's really the Remios line that's leading with its meta-like strength. And here we are the first and only magnesium alloy-based bioabsorbable that's approved in the U.S. And what's so interesting about it is we have bioactive elements that really trigger natural bone growth, which leads to this FDA-recognized claim that our materials and our products, therefore, are osteopromotive. We really promote bone growth. So many times you'll hear in the industry, in the space of absorbables, people making claims such as these are osteointegrative, but these are not FDA-supported claims. These are great marketing claims, I would give you credit, like fantastic ways of marketing things, but they're not FDA-recognized. So Remios truly restores the anatomy to the state that it was before the fracture, which leads to an improved outcome and a quality of life. So you're really getting native bone regrowth, which is just incredible.
What are the elements that provide or promote the bone growth? Is it some sort of peptide or something that you've developed internally? Or
it's the composite. It's the magnesium, zinc, and calcium combination.
The whole combination of them all.
Yeah, and the way that we've put that combination together. In short,
so. What does your current commercial operation look like now? Where are you selling a lot of? Where are you selling a little? Where do you want to sell more to? What's the plan?
Yeah, so we're active in over 40 countries globally.
Mm-hmm.
We're now really focusing in. We've spent a lot of our time outside of the U.S. We've built up a pretty strong distribution network of stocking distributors outside of the U.S., and only in the last few years have we really focused on our U.S. Effort. Remios was approved in Q1 of 2023. And so we've now built out, we're building out our distributor network in the United States. We're also building out some of our direct headcount. We're investing in marketing, and we're really building a brand that people can start to recognize and draw awareness to BioRetech and our world-class material science and products.
So how do you build a sales team for this? Are you working through distributors? Are you building direct? What's the future look like there?
So we have a mix of, you know, we have our own, let's say, VP sales roles that we have in-house that are doing distributor management. Mm-hmm. And outside the U.S., it's all stocking distributors. But in the U.S., we're moving to all direct distribution and sales agents. So we're working with experienced people on our team that are all coming from the orthopedics industry, all come from orthopedics background, have built large distributor businesses in the past for other companies. So more senior type veteran folks in the orthopedic space that can hit the ground running fast for us in the United States.
Is this a space that to get a new customer on board, you're dealing with the technology committees, or are these tools, lower profile enough that you're really dealing with the surgeon and getting them to choose you as their preferred tool? Who's the point of contact for a company like BioRetech?
Yeah. So I think this gets back to the beginning of our conversation and why I love MedTech so much and the pain of adoption. I'd love to say that, you know, it's just another me too that's slotting into a situation where we don't have to go through VAC committees and approvals, but I don't think anywhere in the world that's the case. I mean, we're breakthrough device designated technology, which mm-hmm. really means we are first in the world with Remios. So every time we introduce Remios, we will need to go through, you know, a hospital approval process. And that's whether we're talking Germany or the United States. So those do cause delays in adoption. But so far, we're finding that we are doing well mm-hmm. in those approval processes. So it's a matter of time. But we already have those approvals coming in. And the feedback from the surgeon community that's using the products has been super strong. So we also have that as a tailwind.
How do you break through that to move yourself to separate from the pack is not the right term, but to really distinguish your product from others? Is there a D2C might not work, but do you take sort of unique steps to let folks know that yours is a first in class type of product?
Yeah, I mean it's a great point from the perspective of if you look at, I guess, the other players in our space, there are some who have taken the position of marketing leads. And you're right, there is a little bit of D2C there. There's hashtag this, hashtag that. And mm-hmm. I'd love to put up a billboard about BioRetech and outside of every trauma hospital and say, like, hey, here's a better option to go ask your surgeon. That's one way to spend the capital you raise. But at our heart, we really firmly stand our ground in the science. And so if you look at our adverse event reporting versus our competitors, you know, we're confident in what we're delivering. And so we're investing in both, I guess, the scientific elements of this and the economic perspective, right? We're addressing the economic perspective in two ways. Like the simplest way is, you know, reduced need for removal surgeries and secondary surgeries. That only happens when you have an absorbable material that truly performs. Mm-hmm. If you're using an absorbable that gives the claim of okay, I don't need a secondary surgery, but then there's complications associated with that absorbable, you still have additional cost. So you're not really filling that economic need unless, you know, you're really able to avoid any secondary surgery for any reason. And then I said, like, the second is really that we're an R&D company and material science company at the core. I believe we're world class. And I believe Timo, our CTO, is world class mm-hmm. in that sense. I mean, he's been responsible for over 10 to 15 patent families in the space over the course of his career. So, you know, to maintain that market leadership, we're going to continue to need to advance the thinking and invest in additional R&D, even while we're commercializing our current product portfolio and the pipeline that we've already communicated to the market. And so we're working on hybrid composites and coatings, which are known to have antimicrobial properties, and future generations of the materials that we're working on today that are already getting breakthrough status. And that's how, you know, we plan to maintain and to grow into a market leader.
Yeah, as you answered my D2C question, I came to realize that this is probably, of all med tech, maybe not all, but this is not a big D2C space. I'm not, if I need trauma surgery, I'm not saying take me to that hospital over there because I know they have BioRetech. That's not really
planned surgery. Yeah.
So this is really a pure sell to the hospital, economic, clinical, like old school. This is why you need to be using these products sort of sell.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing I would say, like the one thing I was relieved about, you know, when joining BioRetech was many times when you get something that's breakthrough, right? It generally almost naturally equates to, oh, there's going to be some change in workflow here. Mm. There's going to be some change required. And, you know, the great thing here is that, you know, the performance you need to get used to, the feel a little bit you're getting, but the how the surgeon performs the procedure doesn't change, mm-hmm. right? Everything is the same. And so that's a nice added benefit, I think, to not have to overcome also a workflow challenge when mm-hmm. introducing breakthrough tech. And that's great because the breakthrough part of the tech is, as I said, it's really in the materials.
Final question, just looking forward, what do you see BioRetech becoming in 5 years or so? Are you selling more of these types of implants and screws for orthopedics? Are there applications in other parts of the body? Are you supplying others with this material for their own devices? What do you have a sense of where things are headed?
I think for us right now, and I think many entrepreneurs or CEOs will tell the same, is focus is king.
Sure.
Or queen, in my case. So I would say, you know, our ambition right now is to become a market leader in absorbable implants and bioabsorbable implants driven by world-class material science, period. And I believe that that is absolutely achievable. And that's where our eye is on the target. We are constantly approached about, you know, what's in our pipeline, what materials are in our pipeline, could these be used for different types of applications, and mm-hmm. where could they be used? And I think, you know, further down the road, maybe for a strategic acquirer at some point, that might be a really interesting conversation to have. But for us right now, in terms of, you know, making sure that we achieve our ambition and as a market leader in the space and people understand who BioRetech is and what we're all about, we got to stay focused on our goal, which is, you know, delivering bioabsorbable implants that perform.
So ignore the podcast guy with his stories. Keep your eyes on the ball, people. We'll worry about 5 years, 4.5 years from now. Great. Well, this is a great story, Sarah. I'm glad we learned your story and learned about BioRetech. And thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I will add as a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly. Kayleen, how can folks make sure they never miss a future episode of this or other fine podcasts?
Well, the first thing they can do is go to their favorite podcast player and type in Device Talks one word. The Device Talks Podcast Network gives you access to all of the podcasts through the entire network. So make sure to subscribe there. And if you haven't already, also subscribe to Device Talks on YouTube. And then that way you don't miss an episode of what we've done before and what's to come.
And of course, we would love folks to share this podcast episode on LinkedIn. And when they do, please tag me, tag Kayleen Brown. Of course, you can tag Chris Newmarker and Mass Device, tag Device Talks. And Kayleen, I would love more LinkedIn connections. How about you?
Always, always, always. And actually, I spent this morning about a half an hour on LinkedIn following up from some of the connections that I made at MedTech Vision. And it reminded me, again, what a powerful tool that is. So please connect with us on LinkedIn. We really do read your messages and we really do interact with you. Like, we're real people. So please do.
We really are real people. Yes, I used the QR code thing on LinkedIn a few times this week. It was fantastic. Very helpful.
So easy. So easy. Such a smart addition.
Absolutely. And of course, folks, we'd love to see you at Device Talks West. That is happening October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. Use the code DTWeekly25 to save yourself a little coin and to have a great opportunity to connect with great medtech folks. And more immediately, join us next week for our Device Talks Connected Health Series, Device Talks Tuesdays Connected Health Series. Just had my rehearsal call with Eric Benjamin of Insulet. Going to be a great conversation. You'll have an opportunity to connect with one of MedTech's leaders and join us Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for our upcoming episodes, you can go to devicetalks.com to find details and register. It's free. You can watch live when we're doing it or watch on demand when it's convenient for you. So I think that's a wrap, Kayleen Brown.
Let's do it. We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for joining us, everybody.